Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The Mutiny on the Bounty is perhaps the best-known mutiny in history. Less well-known, but just as interesting, is the mutiny that occurred in the 1820s aboard the whale ship Globe. That's the subject of our conversation this week between Talking History's Eileen Dugan and Gregory Gibson, the author of a new book on the subject. And after that, David Elwood explores the history and meaning of anti-Americanism. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on October 2, 1967, Chief Justice Earl Warren swore in Thurgood Marshall as the first black justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Marshall was born in Baltimore, Maryland in 1908 and studied law at Howard University in Washington, D.C., graduating in 1933, the first in his class. He joined the legal department of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, becoming the NAACP's chief counsel and successfully arguing more than a dozen cases before the Supreme Court. In a landmark victory in 1954 in Brown versus the Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas, Marshall successfully argued that segregation in public schools violated the Equal Rights Clause in the 14th Amendment. President Kennedy appointed Marshall to the U.S. Court of Appeals in 1961. President Johnson named him Solicitor General in 1965, and 2 years later appointed him to the Supreme Court.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, deep sea excavations have begun for the recovery of a 17th century shipwreck off the coast of Gibraltar, which is thought to contain history's richest sunken treasure. Experts believe the wreck of the HMS Sussex, which went down in a storm in 1694, may still hold tons of gold coins worth today as much as $4 billion. The ship was leading a large British fleet into the Mediterranean to help fight a war against France. The gold was to buy the loyalty of the Duke of Savoy, who controlled important invasion routes to Paris. And according to a report in the August issue of Scientific American, what has long been considered myth concerning the oracle at Delphi may actually be reality. According to tradition, the oracle lived in an underground room in the temple of Apollo. She sat on a stool over a fissure in the bedrock through which a gas escaped, putting her in a trance, in which state she could answer questions posed by her guests. Scientists recently found a long hidden fissure or crack in the limestone on that spot, which was the result of two fault lines that crossed at the site. Friction from movement along the fault line, they explain, could have heated chemicals in the limestone, like methane, ethane, or ethylene, causing them to bubble up in the spring water. And that sweet odor could put someone into a trance, much like that described in the myth. This is Talking History. Our guest this week, Gregory Gibson, has written the best-selling book, Demon of the Waters, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Whale Ship Globe. Gibson tells us that true story in a telephone conversation with Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University.
Thanks to the movies, we're all familiar with the tale of the Mutiny on the Bounty. But in the 1820s, there occurred another mutiny aboard the whale ship Globe, a mutiny so violent and its leader such a sociopath that a New York Times book reviewer has dubbed the episode Helter Skelter on the High Seas. What happened aboard the Globe and why? And how did the mutiny set the stage for an even more bizarre tale played out in the South Pacific? With us today to explore this fascinating chapter in maritime history is Gregory Gibson, author of the recent book, Demon of the Waters, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Whale Ship Globe. Hello, Mr. Gibson.
Hi, Eileen.
How did you become interested in the story of the Globe Mutiny in the first place?
Well, I'm an antiquarian bookseller specializing in maritime books, and I've always known about the story of the Globe. There were a couple of narratives written about it in the 19th century. And in 1996, I discovered a journal of one of the sailors that had been sent out to capture these bad guys. And eventually it dawned on me that there might be a book there because it's such a fascinating story and it hadn't been told in a few decades anyway.
And one of the main players in this story is Samuel Comstock from Nantucket. And how would you describe him?
Well, I think a sociopath just about covers it. He was, I don't think he was legally insane, but he was well on his way to that dimension. Manson-esque, certainly Helter Skelter is aptly applied. He was a bad guy.
And what was his background?
Well, he was a Nantucket Quaker. Grew up in New York and Nantucket, sort of a split place. Actually came into his teenage years in New York, but even in his childhood was always what we'd call a troubled youth, rebellious against authority, rebellious against the hegemony of the Quaker faith, and got in a lot of fights, got in a lot of trouble. His daddy sort of kept sending him away to school and finally shipped him out on various ships. He thought he wanted to be a sailor, but he had enormous difficulty with discipline, obviously. And, ultimately the mutiny on the Globe is what resulted.
What was the nature of the Nantucket whaling industry in the time of the Globe incident?
I think it was about at its height. For various reasons, the industry later in the 19th century moved away from Nantucket to New Bedford. But it was, in its day, the big oil business, as we have in the 21st century. Nantucket whaling oil was the big oil of America. It lit our lamps, it lubricated our machines, and we sent it all around the world. So Nantucket was, at that time, a powerful commercial entity.
And what was it like to be on a whaling ship at this time?
Inconceivably to us in the 21st century, inconceivably tough. It was sort of like being in, well, as Johnson says, in a prison that's likely to sink. And it was, you were surrounded by rough guys. The food was terrible. There were interminable periods of awful boredom, punctuated by sharp incidents of life-threatening activity. The discipline was harsh. Desertions were frequent. It was just a rough way of life.
We've all seen Moby Dick and the exciting scenes of chasing whales and killing the whale, but the rendering of the whale, the processing, is pretty grisly. Can you describe that briefly?
Well, it is grisly, and it's again, to modern sensibilities, pretty awful. The first thing that no one thinks about but that predominated the experience was the olfactory element of the experience. A 60-ton slaughtered mammal smelled like hell. They literally peeled the fat, the outer layer of blubber off this creature the way you'd peel an orange, hauled it aboard, chopped it up, and then cooked it, tried it out in big iron pots produce the oil that was the commercially valuable part of the sperm whale. It was very smelly, it was very dirty, and again, it was very dangerous. There's the whale bobbing on the side of the ship, and these guys with razor-sharp cutting instruments are slicing the skin from the blubber from this carcass. Very, very dicey, chancy activity, to say the least.
And as I recall, they would also check the intestines for goodies.
Ambergris, it was called, and it was more valuable by weight than gold. An irreplaceable still element in the manufacture of perfume, interestingly.
So the work on the whale ship Globe is already gruesome, but then there comes to be a mutiny that kind of makes the whaling aspect of it rather pale. How would you describe that mutiny?
Well, it was certainly on a par with the grisliest of modern-day murders. Comstock, with the aid of a couple of bad guys, crewmates, went on a rampage, and he personally slaughtered the captain and the three mates, in other words, the officers of the ship, and then later caused a black steward to be hung, probably on racial grounds. It was a bloodbath.
Was this something that just happened on the spur of the moment, or had Comstock been plotting this?
I think we could say that he had been plotting it. He was obsessed, as disturbed people often are, with the fantasy of living alone on an island. I don't mean disturbed people often have this island fantasy, but he was obsessed in particular with this fantasy of living alone, and he ultimately came to believe that the best way to accomplish this would be to slaughter the crew of a whale ship, take the ship over, and strand it on a remote island. Somehow, in his delusional world, he was able to convince himself that he had enough cause, enough complaint against the officers of this particular whale ship to slaughter them. And he tried, actually, to carry his fantasy out, to land on a desert island.
How successful was he in fulfilling that wish?
Well, I think he had to get himself into a manic state, more or less, or as the psychologists call it, I guess, a florid phase in his dementia to accomplish this. And once he drove the ship to a suitably remote desert island, the whole thing kind of crashed. He just collapsed, more or less, and he wound up getting killed by his own bloodthirsty accomplices.
What happened to those accomplices afterwards?
Well, needless to say, these were not the most delicate guys, nor were they the smartest. There's actually a funny moment in this narrative where, just in this sort of rage and frenzy of blood, they kill their leader, and then they become very depressed because they realize they've just murdered the only guy with enough brain power to conceivably get them out of this. They didn't know how to steer a ship. They didn't know how to navigate. All they could do was scare people. So they became very depressed. That didn't last long. They cheered themselves up by abusing several native women, which was a big mistake because the island where they landed was sort of a matrilineal civilization, and women were very powerful. Probably the worst thing you could have done on that island was abuse a woman. So the natives came and slaughtered all of them except for two survivors, two innocent young boys.
How did people find out that things had gone awry with the Globe, back in the Americas?
Well, it's such a complex story and has so many fascinating little avenues. In the confusion that resulted immediately after Comstock's murder, leading up to his murder, six or seven of the honest crew stole the ship. Comstock was unloading it, was stripping it, was getting ready to burn it so there'd be no evidence. A handful of these good guys stole the ship and snuck it out of the anchorage and sailed on a heroic shorthanded voyage. You can imagine six young men and boys trying to sail a full-rigged sailing ship across 7,000 miles of the Pacific. Somehow they managed to do it. They landed on the coast of South America and warned the Navy. Word got back to Nantucket, and everybody knew about this terrible disaster, and the Navy then sent out a ship to catch the bad guys.
And it's from this ship that was sent out to catch the bad guys, as you say, that we get the narrative of Augustus Strong.
Correct. He was a midshipman on this mission. It was a very dangerous mission, but there wasn't a war going on, so there's a great deal of competition to go on it because this was the way that sailors got advanced. There was question in all of their minds if they'd ever return. Nobody had ever done anything like this. This is one of the first incursions of the Navy into the Pacific, and in fact, it's the first time a naval vessel had stopped at, for example, at Hawaii. So it was important in a political sense as well as in a criminal sense or a sense of justice to capture these wrongdoers.
What did Augustus Strong have to say about his observation? He was only 17 at the time,
yeah.
As I recall.
Yeah, he was a young boy with some literary ambitions. He was very careful to record all the exotic things. You can imagine being from sort of early 19th century American culture, landing in the Marquesas and just having this wealth of beauty and ease and luxury, falling in love perhaps with a native woman, sort of the way Melville had done in Typee, seeing the brutal way that the sailors interacted with with some of the natives on other islands. It was just manifestly the most strange and wonderful adventure he'd ever been on, and he was very aware of that. You get in reading his journal, you get this sense of excitement, this sense of presence that really communicates the extraordinary nature of this experience.
Apart from the strong journal, what other contemporary sources were you able to use?
Well, happily, there were many contemporary sources, because this incident was well documented because it was so notorious and grisly. A couple of people wrote accounts of their adventures. The two survivors from the desert island wrote a book. Nantucket, the ship owners, were very disturbed by this, and a lot of people had a lot to answer for. This was recorded on Nantucket and was preserved. When the guys who stole the ship and sailed to safety in South America to get help for their friends, when they landed, the U.S. consul there took depositions from each of them. So there's a great deal of primary and secondary material about this incident.
But you still, as you mentioned earlier, you brought in a forensic psychologist as well to help you understand Comstock. Can you explain that a bit?
Well, part of it was just fun in an intellectual sense, but its motive was this sense that I had. You know, in the 19th century, they didn't look at people like Comstock from a psychological point of view. There was a sort of more romantic, you know, the 19th century idea of the madman with big wide eyes and tearing his shirt and streaming hair, maybe frothing at the mouth. They had a lot of sort of, insanity is a mystery to everyone still. They explained it perhaps in more romantic or mythological ways, and I thought it would be interesting for 20th century readers to see what a highly trained forensic psychologist, what his take on it would be. So there's just a brief section where Dr. McGee sort of analyzes the case as if it were a modern case, as if it were a criminal case that he had to deal with.
One question that might arise with a reader approaching this book would be, are there any similarities between the story of the Globe and the Bounty?
Well, interestingly, yeah. When Samuel Comstock, the villain of this piece, was a teenager, a whaling captain came back to Nantucket having discovered the ultimate fate of the Bounty. And he, you know, this was a great rumor around the waterfront. I think it was about 1819. Great rumor around the waterfront. You know, what actually happened to these guys? What actually happened to the ship? So it had a profound influence, I think, on young Comstock, particularly at the time when his obsession was just forming, just growing. You know, the rumors of being alone, the only man alone on an island full of native women and native slaves, so to speak, must have exerted a powerful influence on his fantasy.
The Globe Mutiny is certainly a fascinating tale in its own merits, but do you think that the story has any broader meanings in terms of its relationship to American history or in describing the human condition?
It doesn't. In a couple of senses, which fascinated me and which I've dealt with to some degree in the book. In the first place, aside from being a case of law and civilization going out to capture or bring to justice wrongdoers wherever they are, it was an early example of America's imperialistic or empire-driven ideas. It was very important to get this naval ship into the Pacific, to have it stop at several islands, to check on the commerce there, to make sure that Americans were enjoying equal trade rights, to show the flag. And this was explicitly a part of their mission. So in a way, it was the beginning of America's official expansion into the Pacific. The Dolphin, the ship that went to rescue these guys, as I said, was the first ship to touch at Hawaii, and it's not an accident that Hawaii is now a part of our United States. In a deeper and maybe more interesting way, the Globe is a wonderful study of the stories we tell ourselves as Americans over and over again to remind us who we are as Americans, what the central aspects of our character are. And it has all the identifying elements of Americans, you know, the violence, the cruelty, and yet the justice, the bravery, the heroism, the ability to improvise that's particularly American. These guys were just going out there on the rescue guys and the people who were rescued were just operating off the top of their heads in a particularly Yankee or American way. There are so many elements of this story that are so informative to the American psyche, which perhaps explains why it's been told and told and told every generation. You know, my book is just the latest iteration of this story, with perhaps the added value of this strong narrative that had never been known before.
All right, well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today, so thank you, Mr. Gibson.
Well, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay. We have been talking with Mr. Gregory Gibson, author of Demon of the Waters, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Whale Ship Globe.
The shipbird set sail today, set sail today. The captain had the crew in shackles. The edge of the world today, down, down, down. The shipbird set sail today, set sail today.
For our site of the week, we're picking up on our conversation with Gregory Gibson about the mutiny aboard the whale ship Globe and recommending to you a visit to historic New Bedford, Massachusetts. Here to make the connection between the two is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
When you walk the cobbled streets of New Bedford these days, you smell the sea in fresh paint. Once the whaling capital of the United States and one of the richest cities in America, with hundreds of ships calling it their home port, the Massachusetts city fell on hard times when the whaling and later its textile industries collapsed. The city Herman Melville praised for its patrician-like houses and beautiful gardens is coming back, however, and this time's history is setting the agenda. The revival is centered in a 13-block neighborhood designated a national park in 1996. The park is called the New Bedford National Whaling Historical Park, and in the midst of the park is the New Bedford Whaling Museum. The museum houses a half-scale model of a whaling bark that is still some 89 feet long, two full-scale whale skeletons, thousands of items related to the whaling industry, and a world-class collection of maritime prints. If you're interested in whaling, New Bedford should be on your list of places to visit.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. Anti-American sentiment seems not only to be present but even growing in many parts of the world. But as our guest commentator David Elwood suggests, anti-Americanism is not new. Neither is it all alike, wherever it exists, in its context or in its origins.
Anti-Americanism is a catch-all phrase for a variety of thought categories or behavior. It bundles together a lot of people who should really be kept separate. First, those intent on attacking America the nation, the government, the foreign policy, the institutions. Then those who find repugnant whatever or whoever is American, the way of life, the symbols, objects, products, and the people. Finally, there are the critics of Americanism, those who reject the explicit values and ideals of the United States, the principles of the American creed. Classical anti-Americanism, then, mixes up what America is, or is alleged to be, with what America does, or is alleged to do. But the full phenomenon we see today came into being only after passing through an evolution. There have been three broad but distinct phases. First, from the birth of the Republic onwards, came the build-up of all the representations, images, and stereotypes created by the aristocratic travelers from Europe and the emigrants of the 19th century. Then came reactions to the challenge of economic power and the American model of modernization, principally from the 1910s and 20s onwards. Lastly came responses to the organized projection of U.S. political, strategic, and ideological power, anticipated by Woodrow Wilson, but fully realized only after America's entry into World War II. U.S. superpower status post-1945 brought the decisive change. But without the two categories of precedent and pretext supplied by history, this development alone would never have attracted the resentments and envies which classical anti-Americanism has expressed. It's this range of sources which explains why some varieties of the phenomenon are produced by internal crises within the societies which articulate them as much as anything done by America. After the Cold War ended, for instance, explicit resistance took the form not so much of rejection of whatever the United States stood for, produced, or did, but of struggle against the perceived inevitability of convergence on the American pattern. In the American-led year of globalization, in other words, the old 1920s modernization challenge was back. Then came the Iraq crisis to remind us that the hard power question never went away and it is inescapable in any historical discussion of anti-Americanism. But in all the opposition, one could hear more than anger at a foreign policy choice. It was brand backlash which held the day.
You've been listening to David Elwood, professor of international history at the University of Bologna and the author of a forthcoming book on America and the politics of modernization in Europe from 1898 to the present, to be published by Oxford University Press. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History and the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
The edge of town.